is like to die. Left the theater and called the doctor for my appointment to buy tits and ass. Bought myself a fancy pair.
Whoa, and welcome to 80s Movie Montage. This is Derek.
And this is Anna.
And that was like the happiest sounding way of talking about kind of pretty serious like body issues related to, you know, people.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
It was a very upbeat take on plastic surgery.
Yeah. Because like, look, if you listen to throughout the rest of the song, it's not just about tits and ass.
Which,
it's like, hey, nose. It's like a lot.
If it, no judgment, if that's what makes you feel more like you.
Got her there on Broadway.
Cool. In
1985's A Chorus Line.
Yeah. This one was really fun. I'm really excited for the segment as well with our returning guest for this one because she's phenomenal and we had a great conversation. But yeah, A Chorus Line. This is, it's kind of funny because this, it's not our last episode of this season, but it almost kind of serves as a bookend to what was the first episode of this season, Fame.
Yeah.
And we even talk about that with Andy in terms of like the similarities as far as this world, kind of live performance world. Fame, of course, was like a little bit more broken out into like
dance, comedy,
singing,
acting.
Yeah, the whole thing. And this is really focused. I mean, although they do most of those things on stage and just about the different stages in a person's life who, if they choose to pursue this career, like what they have to contend with.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it was an interesting couple of films to see, you know, people just starting off, just like finishing up school, getting into a career in the performing arts. And then people who, in some cases, for some of the characters, were potentially at like the tail end of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm sure most people probably know A Chorus Line as a musical originally. So this is a film adaptation.
Yeah. But the good news, everyone agrees that this is like a super amazing adaptation. Everyone thinks this is the best way to watch A Chorus Line. Am I right? No? Is that
what? Right. Yeah. I mean, I think we go down that path a little bit with Andy in terms of like people's response to the way that they changed this. And that you said segued me perfectly into the written by credits, because included into those credits are the gentlemen who originated this material on stage.
Okay.
So first we have Michael Bennett.
Mm-hmm.
So he's, as far as like IMDb is concerned, he's credited with concept. So he had the original idea, so to speak, for Chorus Line.
And he provided feedback for the movie production and they listened to everything he said, right? Right? Okay, never mind. Okay, what's going
on? The answer is no. I mean,
we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah. So the way that he, and now, to be fair, I've seen a number of musicals. A Chorus Line is not one of them. I have not seen that particular musical. So I don't have firsthand experience in terms of the story that's told for the musical version of it. But because he conceptualized A Chorus Line, he also has credits for the 2016 version of A Chorus Line.
Hmm.
And I guess they're it says it's like upcoming, but they're going to do a TV miniseries.
Okay, that would work.
A Chorus Line. Yeah,
like
I think
each episode could be kind of like one of the performers kind of giving their story.
Yeah, I think that actually could work really well. So unfortunately, it's going to be a little bit of a refrain for the next couple of credits. He passed just a couple years after this film came out. He passed away in 1987. He was just 44 years old. So yeah, we did not get to see more from him. Who knows what other great stories he would have come up with. But that is Michael Bennett. Now moving on to the two gentlemen who, now I'll be really honest. Like, I'm not well versed in how musicals are produced, what materials need to come together for their realization.
Okay.
but James Kirkwood Jr. and Nicholas Dante are both credited with the book. So I don't know if with every musical there's like, maybe it's like in terms of like for a film you need a script. So I don't know if for like a musical you need a book.
Interesting.
But they're credited with the book of A Chorus Line. And they, I think, primarily were in the like live performance sphere in the musical world.
Okay, so we're going to have a book, the musical, an actual in theater musical, the movie adaptation times two, and then a TV series. So we're kind of like reaching the limits of how we can express this.
Well, it's interesting because like, so James Kirkwood Jr. and Nicholas Dante, even though they both did this book, they don't have the same IMDb credits. So I don't think that they were like always working together. Like sometimes we see partnerships where they just did everything together. That's not the case here. For Kirkwood Jr., the two credits that I have for him besides this, I guess he also was a novelist. He has a novel and screenplay credit for a film called Some Kind of Hero.
Okay.
And then he has a novel slash play credit. So I guess this was like an adaptation of what he wrote. It's called P.S. Your Cat is Dead.
Okay. That's an important P.S.
So that's Kirkwood Jr. Now Dante. And unfortunately, both of these gentlemen, they've also passed away. So Kirkwood Jr., he passed away just 2 years after Bennett. He passed away in 1989. He was 64, so he's a little bit older. Then Dante, he passed away in 1991. He was also fairly young. He was only 49. So unfortunately, all the gentlemen who came together to create this musical did not really get to live. I mean, they did because like it was on Broadway. Like they did get to see it, obviously. Oh, yeah. But like to your point, just a couple minutes ago, you know, there's been other iterations of this musical and they haven't really been able to be around to experience that. But his two credits, there was, I guess, a 1991 version of A Chorus Line. I don't know why really? Bennett isn't credited for it, okay. But Dante is. And then he also gets the 2016 credit. Oh. So interesting credits between the three of these. Then, so the fourth and final person that we have for a written by credit is Arnold Schulman. So he did the screenplay for the film.
Okay.
And he thankfully was able to be with us for much, much longer. He only passed away this year. He was 97 years old.
Amazing.
Yeah. And because of that, we have more credits to speak of for his work. So he started in television, it seems like, had a lot of kind of one-off, like written by credits for different shows. But among some of his other credits, we have the films Wild is the Wind.
Hmm.
A Hole in the Head.
Okay.
Cimarron. So that's a well-known one. He is a nominated writer. So he has a Best Original Screenplay nomination for Love with the Proper Stranger. And then he has a Best Adapted Screenplay nomination for Goodbye, Columbus.
Oh, okay.
He also, and except for like kind of his beginnings in TV, I have like all films for him. He has credits for Funny Lady, Tucker, The Man in His Dream, and I guess, so, okay.
Oh, I know both of those. I mean, I've never seen Funny Lady, but I'm aware of it, and I've certainly heard of Tucker.
Okay. I guess I spoke too soon, because I do have, and this was like, I think, a TV miniseries or TV movie, and the band played on.
Oh, yeah.
It was a TV movie. Yeah. Which, to my knowledge, like when I was kind of going down a little rabbit hole about his work, he, like some of the characters, I guess, were inspired, one in particular, by Michael Bennett. So I think that, and the band played on. So to address the fact that all those other gentlemen died pretty early and all within quick succession of each other, they all passed from complications of AIDS.
Okay.
And so Schulman, I think in a way, him writing that TV movie was like a tribute, like an honor to honor those gentlemen. So, okay, moving on to directed by, familiar name, but I mean, we haven't actually really talked about him, but probably a lot of people know him, Richard Attenborough.
This guy spared no expense.
Yeah!
That's right. That's
from his Hammond from Jurassic Park.
Yeah. If you had told me that Michael Douglas was going to star in the film adaptation of a musical directed by the guy from Jurassic Park that spared no expense.
And this is obviously pre-Jurassic Park.
Yeah. No, it's just, it's a very interesting interconnected series of actors and events and everything.
Yeah, I do wonder how many people, I mean, I don't think I was really, I think maybe I knew he directed stuff, but I didn't know what. I certainly didn't know that he directed this. That came as a surprise to me. And maybe, probably, most people know him from his acting work more so. But yeah. He does have a fair number of directing credits, and that's what I have listed. So I have just directing credits since that is...
That's what we're talking about.
Correct.
For him in this capacity.
In this particular film. So among his credits, I had to put this one in, even though I don't know what the film is.
I already know what it's going to be. I already know what it's going to be. Young Winston.
Correct. Because our little fur baby is Winston.
I'm looking at him taking a nap right here.
Yeah. So I had to put that one in.
That's amazing.
Young Winston. I should probably maybe not say the name because I don't want to, if he thinks we're like calling him.
No, he doesn't listen to us.
He did A Bridge Too Far. I did not realize this. He's actually an Oscar winning director. He won Best Director for Gandhi. And then he was also, I guess, a producer on it because he also was part of the group that won Best Picture.
I had no idea.
Me neither.
I had no idea. I know that he's done like narration stuff, right?
Well, and his brother too, because it's his brother who does all the Planet stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But yeah, I hadn't a clue. And then he also directed Chaplin with Robert Downey Jr., Shadowlands, and In Love and War.
There is literally no movie title that I can think of that instantly makes my dad super emotional more than Shadowlands.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
I didn't know that.
That movie deeply affected him.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
So much so that I've never even watched it because I'm like, oh my God, I'm not sure if I'm ready for this.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. Moving on. Cinematography. Ronnie Taylor. So what we will see with some of the next couple individuals that I'm about to bring up, that they, you know, work together with Attenborough on Gandhi, as well as maybe a couple other projects. But for cinematography, Ronnie Taylor, some of his credits, I have all films. So we have Tommy. He won.
Oh, that makes sense, because Tommy was also a musical of sorts.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. He won Best Cinematography for Gandhi. So Gandhi took home a bunch of Oscars.
People like that movie.
Yeah. He did Cry Freedom, Sea of Love. He did the 1998 version of The Phantom of the Opera.
Okay.
He's no longer with us, so his final credit was a film called Sleepless.
You know what else he was a camera operator on?
Camera operator what?
Young Winston.
Oh, was he?
Yes.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, here's a gentleman that actually... we did bring up, I don't think too long ago, Marvin Hamlisch.
Call to action.
We brought him up this season, I believe, because he had participation in Ordinary People.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
So now he did win Best Original Song, or I'm sorry, he got a nomination for Best Original Song for this film. But I don't think I mentioned this the last time we brought him up. He was accepted into Juilliard at 7 years old.
Holy shit.
7 years old.
That is super impressive.
That is really impressive.
What the?
Yeah.
Wow.
So his work, I can't say that he, like, okay, so when you're going through the credits on IMDb, usually there's like a clear category that just says like music by or
it is a
composed
list of people.
Yeah. So they don't have that for this film because it's a different kind of movie. It was adapted from a musical.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if you scroll a little bit, you do find finally a music by credit with him there. Mm-hmm. But I think his participation was not conventional, like where they just hire a composer and they do the score for a film. Mm-hmm. He had to work with what was already created for the musical.
He had to work with the pre-existing Tits and Ass, otherwise known as Dance 10 Looks 3.
There you go.
Yeah.
So Let me go through his work. It's kind of all over the place in terms of like what he did, because sometimes it's like score work, sometimes it's song work. I tried to include, and I probably did this the last time around, you know, the ways that he was recognized by the Academy Awards. So okay. He worked on the film Bananas. He got a nomination, Best Original Song, for Koch. He won Best Original Song as well as Best Original Score for The Way We Were.
Oh, okay.
That makes sense. He got Best Original Song Score for The Sting.
Yeah, that, man, that song is amazing. I like that movie. There's so many like good things about that movie, but the music is just excellent.
Yeah. He got a Best Original Song and so he's playing double duty with a lot of these films. Best Original Score nominations for The Spy Who Loved Me.
Man, I was hoping you're going to bring that one up. That's great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Best Original Song nom for Same Time Next Year.
Okay.
Another Best Original Song nom for Ice Castles. Couple other films, Starting Over, Seems Like Old Times. He gets another Best Original Score nomination for Sophie's Choice. Like I said, he worked on Original People, Ordinary People. He also worked on Three Men and a Baby. So he really kind of swings both. Well,
they're almost like the same movie.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. It's like he has a lot of diversity in his work. He gets another Best Original Song. Now, man, it's a mouthful to keep saying this, for Shirley Valentine. He also worked on The January Man, Frankie and Johnny, as well as another Best Original Song nomination for The Mirror Has Two Faces.
Okay.
There you go. Okay.
Incredible. So,
thank you. Well, you probably meant him, not me.
No, I meant primarily you, but also he gets a little bit of credit.
He gets a little bit of credit. Yeah. So moving on to editing, he actually did get another Oscar nomination for this particular film, John Bloom.
Okay.
So he has won an Oscar. I did put this in for the same reason. He edited on a film called The Winston Affair.
What is going on?
I know.
Why?
Isn't that fun?
Why are there so many Winston movies?
Yeah. I thought that was really cute. So I had to put that one in. He worked on The Lion in Winter, the 1979 version of Dracula. He gets an editing nomination for The French Lieutenant's Woman.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. So he worked with Attenborough on Gandhi as well. Won for best editing on that film. He did Bright Lights, Big City, Air America, Nobody's Fool, First Wives Club, Shaft, Closer, Notes on a Scandal, great film.
The 2000 version of Shaft.
Correct. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying. And then also I have Charlie Wilson's War.
That was a fun movie.
Never saw it.
It's okay.
Okay. So we are already at the stars of this film. So arguably, there's only one person that's probably pretty well known.
As far as being on the big screen, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. As far as,
I can't
like,
really say for
strictly
for,
acting.
Yeah, for yeah. a lot of people, I assume there were a lot of like, you know.
Dancers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just don't, I'm not as familiar.
Same here. So we are starting with Zach. He is, I guess, the choreographer, and I feel like he's more than just the choreographer on whatever musical they were. Well, was it? It was for.
I don't know. I know what you're trying to ask.
Yeah,
and I don't
yeah.
know.
Gosh, am I just completely missing what music? Like, is it that meta? Like, were they casting for that? You were casting the chorus for a chorus line in the film, a chorus line?
That was exactly the question I expected you to ask, and I thought about it while you were asking.
Yeah.
It. Still don't know
I
the
still
answer.
Don't know.
Call to action.
Yeah. So Michael Douglas.
Yeah.
And it's funny because his one Oscar win, and actually if you look at his IMDb, not as many credits as you would think. I think he had like 60 something when I looked.
But they're all ones you'll recognize.
Yeah. For the most part. He's just so well known. Obviously, he comes from like a Hollywood family.
Yes.
But his one Oscar win is not for acting at all. It's because he was part of the producing team on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
And that happened so early in his career. I mean, that was 75, so.
I knew it wasn't for the Jewel of the Nile, but maybe the Star Chamber. I don't know.
Oh, you know what? I'm a liar.
Oh,
God. He did win Best Actor for Wall Street. I forgot about that one.
Okay, yeah. Well, greed is good.
But, yeah, it's still interesting, though, that he got that other Oscar so early on and not even for what he is known for. I wonder how much producing he has done since then. Like, I feel like he is more firmly in the acting part of things, but who knows? His credits. So early in his career, I just put this one down because I thought it was funny. He was in a TV movie called When Michael Calls.
Okay.
And his name's Michael Douglas. I just thought that was funny. But he plays a character named Craig, so he's not Michael. Just thought that was funny. Okay. So moving on.
Amazing.
He was, I think most people know him as a film actor, but he also early in his career was on a show called The Streets of San Francisco for a while.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I remember that.
Oh, I do not.
I mean, just because, you know, back in the day, there'd be reruns of shows like that. Sure, sure. There you go.
Yeah. So now I think I do have all. He comes back to TV actually much, much, much later in his career. I didn't even watch some of this show. But in the interim, he was in The China Syndrome. So you just mentioned the sequel. He was in both Romancing the Stone and The Jewel of the Nile.
Mm-hmm.
So when he first kind of came to attention, including this film, I don't, you know, like a lot of people now really associate him with that like erotic thriller type of film from like the late 80s and early 90s.
Really?
Well, hello, Fatal Attraction, Basic Instinct. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I forget
Disclosure.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah. So, and that's the next one I was going to bring up. So first was like Fatal Attraction. So obviously that just was super popular for probably all the wrong reasons in terms of like Glenn Close being this like deranged whatever, and he comes out looking like the good guy when he cheated on his wife.
Yeah, he wasn't the good guy.
No,
in that
he wasn't
movie,
the
was
good
he?
Guy. But they totally position Close's character as like, oh, she's the crazy one.
His wife had to kill someone because of him.
Poor guy. He just wanted to have a weekend affair with somebody while his wife didn't know, and then it just all got out of hand. But anyway,
it was all a big misunderstanding.
All
a
big
sure.
misunderstanding. And like I mentioned, I had forgotten, but he did win Best Actor for Wall Street. He did come back to that sequel that was not too long ago, Wall Street Money Never Sleeps.
Okay.
He was in that as well. He was in, so he teamed up with, for a while, him and Kathleen Turner were like a fun little duo because they did Romancing the Stone, Jewel of the Nile, and then The War of the Roses.
Yeah, I couldn't follow this trilogy very well because it seemed like things were going really
well. It is funny if you think of it as a trilogy. Yeah, and then even Danny DeVito's in it.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
Wait, is this not? No, I know it's not.
Okay. I was like, did you know it's not, right? And then here we go. So he's in Basic Instinct, Falling Down, Disclosure. But then he, like, swings wide the other way, and he's in The American President.
Yeah.
So this is a good movie, The Game, with Sean
Excellent.
Penn.
Excellent. Yeah. That movie is really good. Yeah.
He's in that. Wonder Boys, Traffic, Behind the Candelabra.
Behind the Candelabra.
He's, Liberace.
Oh, yeah.
And then he enters big time into the MCU. So he is in Ant-Man and the Wasp, Avengers Endgame, as well as Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania.
And I'm not sure if you, did you mention The Ghost in the Darkness?
I didn't.
Because.
You like that movie?
I want to like it more than I actually do, because when they marketed that movie, when it first came out, they were trying to sell that to people as though it was Jaws.
Sure.
On the plains, you know.
Yeah.
And you know what?
Not so much.
Not as much. Like, Val Kilmer's in that. It's not a bad movie, mm-hmm. but it's an interesting movie.
And then I mentioned just a minute ago that he does return to television. And so it's already not, like, in production anymore.
Oh, the Comiskey Method, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. with Alan Arkin. Yeah. Okay, so moving on to Terrence Mann. I just think it's so funny that this actor's name is the same
guy
as
from the guy from Field of Dreams, right?
Right, right. Yeah. I know. So Terrence Mann, the actor,
oh,
plays a character named Larry. Larry is kind of Zach's right-hand man. He's the one that helps to facilitate these auditions. And he is hands down my favorite character of this entire film. He's fascinating to watch. I just think he's great in this movie.
Yeah. Agreed. He is great because his like acting ability and dancing, like they're all, he's just excellent at
everything. Yeah.
Which is tough. Like obviously Michael Douglas is not dancing in this movie and a lot of the dancers, they're solid acting, mm-hmm. but Mann was just exceptional at both.
Totally agree with you. So I can't say, though, that I'm super familiar with his acting career. I mean, of the credits I have for him, it's like kind of a even split, so to speak, between film and television. He was in Critters, as well as Critters 2, The Main Course. Mm. He has his own franchise because he's in that, as well as Critters 3 and 4. So he's in all four Critters movies.
Well done.
So we'll have to watch that sometime. He is in Big Top Pee Wee.
Oh, the sequel to mm-hmm. Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Okay.
And then here's his TV work. He was in The Dresden Files, Sense8, and Foundation.
Yes, I didn't make that connection, but he is... So they have, like, cloned their the leaders. And there's, like, always three versions of them. Like Brother Dusk, Brother Dawn. I don't know what the middle-age one is. Yeah, so there's like always like three iterations of them. It's very strange. It doesn't really remind me of the books at all, but nevertheless, based off of an Isaac Asimov series of books. Yeah.
Cool.
Moving on.
All right, so now we have Sharon Brown. She plays Kim. She's not given a ton to do, but she is Zach's assistant.
Yeah.
So, but I do want to bring her up. We talk about her with Andy, and even though she doesn't have a lot to do in this movie, she's had a great acting career. Like, she is one of the people on my list that has a more sizable filmography. So, and I mean, that could be because she really, maybe, perhaps, I don't want to speak on her behalf, but identifies more as an actor than a dancer. So those kinds of credits are going to come up in IMDb. But among her credits, so really early in her career, she was on an episode of Good Times, The mm-hmm. Jeffersons. Then, yeah, I do have some TV work for her. But among her film work, she was in The Dozens. We covered this film, but she certainly didn't come up. She's in the director's cut of Legend. I don't think she was a major character.
I don't know how many there may have been, Fairy Firelight Dancer.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm not... Yeah, I'm not sure.
She's in Four Keeps? Question mark.
Was it? Is it?
Yeah, that's the Molly Ringwald movie. Mm. So, TV work. Back to TV. She was in 73 episodes of Generations. So I think that was like her mainstay type project.
Okay.
She was in Sister Act 2, Back in the Habit, Blues Brothers 2000.
Sorry, I still was stuck on Generations because for a second I thought you meant Star Trek. Generation.
Star Trek. That's not... Just Generations.
Just Generation. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then the TV movie Introducing Dorothy Dandridge.
Okay.
So, all right. So, for the rest of my list, mm-hmm. a lot of these people, this was like kind of, for about half of the people I have left, their first credit in the acting world or like their first film credit, so really early in all their careers, if they even were like trying to kind of move down that path of acting versus like dancing, because I think for the rest of the people they maybe are primarily dancers. First of which, Allison Reed, she plays Cassie, so she's Zach's ex-girlfriend, the mm-hmm. one who comes back, and it's the whole thing.
It is a whole story. Yeah, it really is. Did it need to be?
I mean, that's a great question.
Bennett didn't seem to think so.
This was her first acting credit, period.
Okay.
This is like the very beginning. So I have mostly television for her, actually. But another film she did, Skin Deep. And then for the different series she was on Ghost Rider, Party of Five, Felicity. I was watching a little bit of Felicity the other day again.
What?
It's a good show.
All right.
The Agency. She was on Desperate Housewives. She did do, I mean, this was just a couple years ago. She was in the film Ad Astra with Brad Pitt.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then more recently, this is a mouthful, the TV show High School Musical, colon, the musical, colon, the series.
Come on.
I know. That's just, I mean, that's got to be a joke, right?
I don't know. IMDb takes this very seriously.
Well, I mean, the people who decided upon the title of that project.
Probably.
I don't know. And then she just has done a lot of like TV one-offs.
So she she did voice work in at least one game, and normally I wouldn't bring it up, but it is Diablo 3, which was a huge, huge game.
Okay.
And she was Adria, the witch.
Okay.
Yeah.
So moving on to, my apologies if I'm not pronouncing this correctly, Yamil Borges?
That sounds perfect.
Okay. So she plays Morales. She is the dancer who I somewhat ordered my list of credits in terms of like what I felt, you know, going from the most screen time to the least screen time.
She was the one who was called up to the front line and then Michael Douglas says, "Oh no, please step back."
At the very end. Yes.
And she had just a roller coaster of emotions.
Yes. Yes. She was great. This was her first credit too.
She was really good.
So this is one of the ones where I think she's maybe more so, you know, a dancer than actor. I don't have a ton of credits. For the next several people, I don't have a ton of credits.
Okay.
I mostly TV from her for her in all like kind of single appearances. So she did one episode of Miami Vice, one episode of The Cosby Show.
Okay.
One episode, I don't think this was a U.S. property.
I don't think so.
Verbatim Liebe.
Yeah.
Liebe?
Yeah.
And then a couple films, The Luckiest Man in the World, as well as Four Senses.
Okay.
Okay, so moving on to, and yeah, some of these people I'm going to be kind of rattling through pretty quickly because of the absence.
Rattle on.
Of credits. Cameron English. So he plays Paul. Paul is the one who hurts his knee.
Yes.
In case people are like, who's Paul?
He has the very sincere and honestly very moving story about like his first job, his parents coming out.
Traumatic childhood.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
The whole deal.
He was excellent in this.
Mm-hmm. He was. This was his first feature credit. He only has a total of 7 credits. So again, I think mostly a dancer.
Okay.
However, one huge exception, he was on, now this makes all the sense in the world, he was in 60 episodes of the TV series Fame.
Oh my God.
So there you go. Yeah.
Amazing.
He was, they classify this as a short, Captain EO, the Michael Jackson thing.
Oh, yeah. So I don't even know what they have there now, but they used to, at Disneyland, and I'm assuming at, like, Epcot maybe in Florida, they just had, like, movies.
Mm-hmm.
You'd go and see, like, little short movies.
Yeah.
They were, like, 3D. Like, ways for them to showcase different technology.
Yeah. So he's in that. And then a couple films, Rented Lips. And then I've said it before, I love this movie. He has a part in Death Becomes Her.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on to Vicky Frederick. She plays Sheila. Sheila is, among the dancers, the one who probably is the oldest. She kind of jokes around about being a little older.
She's got a 9-year-old.
She has a 9-year-old. She kind of is introduced as being a little bit over it. Like she, I was even thinking like, does she know somebody and she knows she's going to make it through the initial cuts? Because she doesn't even really complete the auditions in the same way that other people do. She, like, walks off stage, kind of hanging out. She's not, like, it's...
Because she really wants it. She doesn't expect it, almost, because... Yeah. So, yeah, there's, like, all of these different, like, feelings of tension between, like, her presence there.
And she's trying to act like nothing can really get to her.
Yeah.
Yeah. So... She's so familiar looking to me. I was like, God, she's had to have been in more stuff. So I don't know where I'm like, identifying her because I'm like, she looks really familiar to me.
It's probably from that one episode of Murder, She Wrote.
Well, the couple things that I have for her, I thought this was really interesting because Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, and Mork and Mindy all share the same universe.
They do. Yeah, it's wild when you think of it that way. But yes, they all exist in the same
Happy Days universe.
Yeah,
and she had appearances on all three shows. Now, what's interesting about that is for Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley, she plays the same character, but she doesn't play the same character on Mork and Mindy.
What if I told you on that Mork and Mindy, it was the evil twin?
Shut up.
I don't know. They did a lot of that. It could be, but I don't know.
Okay. Well, on the first two shows, she plays a character named Helga.
Okay.
And then on Mork and Mindy, she plays a character named Sutra.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Evil twin.
Yeah.
Okay. A couple of her other credits. I had to put this down. She's in a film called Chopper, Chicks, and Zombie Town.
Oh, my God. That sounds amazing.
Right? And a film called Scissors.
Okay.
All right. So moving on to the performer who is in our intro, Vale, played by Audrey Landers. I think she's a pretty, outside of Michael Douglas and probably Terrence Mann, I think she is maybe the most familiar looking. Mm-hmm. Now we're kind of swinging the pendulum back to people who probably firstly consider themselves actors. And in fact, I think I read that she's the only one of those like 20 performers who made it to the penultimate cut, that they did have some body double work for her because she couldn't
The irony of all this.
Right?
Good Lord. But it was because she
because of the lack of dancing experience. Yeah. So
she's singing a song about not looking good enough, but dancing. Great dancing. But in reality, she was likely cast because of, looks 10, dances.
Yeah. No, three. You're right. You're absolutely right with the irony.
That is amazing.
So I do have all TV work for her. So she's done like one-offs, but then she's also had some kind of recurring stints on certain shows. She was on Somerset, Highcliffe Manor. She played a couple of different characters on both Fantasy Island and The Love Boat. Her big mainstay was Dallas. She was on 84 episodes of Dallas.
That'll do it.
Yep. She was also on One Life to Live and then more recently, Burn Notice.
And of course, we cannot forget one episode of the 1970s version of Battlestar Galactica.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
The last three people I have, the two of the three, just to make it easy on everybody listening, they're the married couple.
Oh, yeah.
So the guy in that couple, his name's Al. This was his first feature credit. I think for the remaining three people, all three of them, primarily dancers again, instead of like maybe actors.
Okay.
But his name is Tony Fields. And yeah, he, I guess was liked by Michael Jackson. He's in several of his projects. So he was in Beat It. He was also in Thriller.
Oh, man, that's amazing.
Yeah,
that's
awesome. So he must have been one of the zombies.
He was, yeah.
And he also was in Captain EO.
Okay.
Yeah. So he did all that. He was in the 1986 film Trick or Treat. So not the film we just watched, Trick or Treat. Trick or
Trick
Treat.
Okay.
He was in the film Dance Academy. He was on the TV series. He did have a stint on Santa Barbara. He was on for 11 episodes. And then he also did the films The Doctor and Across the Moon.
I'm sorry I have so many of these one-offs to add.
That's
but
okay.
This series was basically like a horror version of The Incredible Hulk because it was about a guy who had this thing. He's trying to figure out how to fix it. And the series was Werewolf, but it was like a crime-fighting werewolf who wandered from town to town trying to figure out how to kill the werewolf that turned him. But in the meantime, he would like help other people.
Okay.
It got one season, I think.
That's very interesting. And
no satisfying ending, really. Aww. But yeah, that was a kind of a fun show.
So it was a Netflix series?
No, it was on Fox.
Sorry.
And he was in one episode.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on to people if they're in the musical world, the Broadway world, they will certainly recognize this last name, Nicole Fosse.
Hmm.
So she plays Christine. So she's the wife in that couple, the one who is like very insecure, very uncomfortable, especially being asked questions about herself.
Yeah.
She, in real life, is the daughter of Bob Fosse and Gwen Verdon. So there was even a miniseries, right? Not too long ago with Michelle Williams.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, Fosse Verdon, I think it was called. And so, yeah, both of her parents... arguably, you know, the most well-known figures of the Broadway world, Fosse in particular. I don't think her world was strictly in acting. She only has 4 credits total. So I also don't really know if she followed in her parents' footsteps. I don't know if she so much was a dancer either, but, of a couple of her credits, I do think this is fun. She was in the film All That Jazz, which
that is fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
With Chief Brody.
Yes, with Chief Brody.
Yeah.
And then 1 episode of Miami Vice.
Why? Man, there is a real Chorus Line Miami Vice connection.
There is, isn't there?
Yeah.
Okay, lastly, last on our list, we have Janet Jones, who plays Judy.
Oh.
JJJ.
Yeah.
Honestly, okay, so first of all, if you're like, who's Judy? She's the one that's from El Paso, and... That's kind of how she said it.
Okay.
And she, I'm trying to think of everything else to differentiate. Like, she just seems very like.
She was the first person called when they did like the final cut. When
that's right. And yeah. She was like, I think, didn't she like not know her number? They had to like call her a couple times or something like that.
Yeah, I think yeah. So.
She, I don't want to say that like she doesn't have her own things to. Stand upon as far as achievements. I hate framing it this way, but maybe more people might know her as Wayne Gretzky's wife in real life. So
they might not, but they'll know Wayne Gretzky.
Right.
So they'll be like, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So yes, she did go on to marry Gretzky, but you know, even I mean, they got married, I don't know, a couple years after this film came out. And she has continued to work. It's not like she gave up working just to marry the guy. But among her credits, I have all films. So, like, kind of pre-Gretzky era.
Mm-hmm.
She was in Annie. She was in Grease, too.
Yes, her credit is amazing.
What's her credit?
She is credited as the girl goosed in class.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
She was in The Beastmaster.
Movie has not aged well.
Staying Alive. The Flamingo Kid. I didn't realize she was in A League of Their Own.
One of the racing pitchers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Alpha Dog, The Sound and the Fury, and more recently, American Siege.
Okay.
The last credit is kind of it is exactly a compilation. I was just super curious because, like, I was going through, you know, everybody that's on IMDb, and I just kept seeing dancer, 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 dancer. And I'm like, how many fucking dancers did they have credited here? They have credited and uncredited dancers.
Mm-hmm.
And then other kind of variants of dancers, like reject dancers is what some of them are called.
That's rough. That's going to follow you around in a resume.
Yeah, I just was like, I'm going to do this. And so I counted.
Okay.
They had 142 other dancers.
Nice. That's a lot of dancers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of people were part of this. Film synopsis.
Yeah. Is it about
dancing? This might be the most cut and dry one that we've ever had. Hopefuls try out before a demanding director for a part in a new musical.
That's it. You know, I mean, yeah, I've no real experience with, you know, I've already talked about my lack of familiarity with the dancers, although I knew someone who was related to one of my best friends.
Okay.
Who was a dancer and like was serious and been in like music videos, I think. And it was always very interesting because if you just walked into a store and there was a song on, they would just start dancing.
Okay.
And I would look over and be like, what's happening? He's like, I just got to dance. It was incredible.
Okay.
Sadly, he's not in this movie because he would not have been born yet. But
oh, okay.
You never know.
Sure. Well, on that note.
Yeah, on that note.
Let's get into it with our special returning guest, Andy.
Let's do it.
All right. We are so very excited to have this amazing person back on the show. Andy Smith-Peake was with us back in season 3. So that was just the previous season. Probably around summertime is when we had her on. And at that time, we talked about Clue, which we all love, and she was amazing. So we encourage you to go back to that episode to hear her thoughts on that film. But today, we have her for A Chorus Line. And Andy, she is a writer, a stand-up comedian, improviser. She's worked on various shows for Netflix, Warner Brothers, A&E. Now she also adds to the resume drama teacher. And I thought it was amazing because I think she does have amazing wisdom to bestow upon the next generation. She also wanted to add inflicting pain on the next generation of those in the arts. But I do totally get that. And actually flows right into probably where this conversation is going to go today.
It's very on point.
Very on point. And again, we are just over the moon to have her back on the podcast. Welcome back, Andy.
Thank you. Thank you, Derek and Anna. I'm over the moon myself, under the sun, in the stars. So excited to be talking about A Chorus Line with you guys.
I feel so like when we had you on for Clue, I was like, this is the perfect movie and the perfect, like, perfect mashup of guest and movie. And then we watched this, and I don't know if you realized, Andy, that this was a first viewing for both Derek and I.
Very rare.
That's very rare.
I'm so excited to hear what you guys think. Yeah.
And then after watching A Chorus, I was like, nope, this is actually, I mean, not that it's like one or the other, but I'm like, this again, perfect mashup of guest and movie. And as I normally do, really the only question I ever have on tap is just, I'm so curious to know if you do have, and not a wrong answer if you don't, but if you have first memories of seeing this movie and if you have any like recollection of like how it impacted you the first time that you saw it.
Yeah, I do. I did see it. I probably saw this around the same time as Clue, probably on that Canadian movie channel, seeing movies that probably were too old for my young, like, adolescent ears and eyes. but I remember watching it, and it was such a body image experience on top of all the like themes that are probably quite adult for my teenage eyes. But yeah, I do remember it opened up the world to me quite a bit. I used to be in ballet school and I used to study dance. So this was such an eye-opening experience of what adult dance world would maybe be like.
Do you remember as far as like timeline, when you saw this movie, were you already in dance class or was it did this precede you going into classes for dance and ballet?
Oh, this definitely was after. Like I was in ballet school when I was younger. And I think I was transitioning into sports at this point. But the image of like that pressure as a female in the 80s, and I guess this is more from the 70s, but still like that need to look a certain way, that really spoke true. It was a lot to live up to back in the 80s, I remember. I remember dieting as like a young teenager.
I'm so glad that you brought this up. It is a surprising aspect of it, but something that I didn't really like say anything to you when we watched it, Derek, because it's a weird circumstance because I think, not to exclude men certainly can feel pressure.
I mean, look, did you see that guy in the Steelers jersey? Don't tell me he didn't have body issues. That guy had been working it to get to that
Andy,
point.
Andy, do you know who we're talking? He got cut, but he was the one that had like the Pittsburgh jersey with the white, very, very, very tight pants.
Oh, he was rocking it. Totally. Yep. Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
So not to say that men can't, and especially within that world, have pressure as well to look a certain way, but it's something that I feel is just so constant with women. And it certainly can be through any age. And Andy, I'm right there with you. Like I remember at 13 years old feeling already a certain way about how I was supposed to present myself. And that extended to like diet and hair and clothing and the whole thing. And you're totally right. Like, this movie, and it's not a, it's certainly not me incriminating the film. It's part of what that world legitimately was and probably still is, honestly. But
the impossibility of achieving that body, yes. But they worked on it every day, all day. And yep. Yet, you know, like regular women in society felt like that was the standard. Like, I remember mm-hmm. feeling like that much more then than I ever do now. But I'm sure that mm-hmm. still exists for many women nowadays. Absolutely. Yeah.
And like, actually a friend of ours, her daughter, she's a little bit older now, but when she was kind of in her mid-teens, she had an interest in ballet. And I really appreciate that our friend and her daughter both had a very healthy perspective on it. But she very candidly told me that, like, the teachers were telling her daughter she needed to drop weight. And this is, like, just maybe 2 or 3 years ago. So it's – and she was at the time, like, 15 years old. So yeah,
that's messed up.
Yeah. So, yeah, definitely still, I think, part of that world. But to your point, Andy, like, even in just certain scenes where – I don't think the intention per se was to, although the whole film, like, everybody's body is on display, but I don't think the intention was to, in that moment, highlight physicality. But even just during one of the musical, which I know that's most of the movie, but like during one of the solos, you know, she was wearing like a crop top. And so I was like just observing her midsection and I was like, wow, like just the fitness level.
I don't even know who you're talking about.
Well, we can just get into it. It's the tits and ass.
Oh,
yeah, number. Dance 10 Looks 3, okay. that song,
yep.
Yeah.
Yep, yep.
But it also brought this into the conversation, like having a musical number about it, and mm-hmm. like that is talking about it, starting that conversation about those ideals, yeah.
It's a very meta. I mean, it's almost as meta as you get. Movie.
Well, it's a musical about a musical. It's yeah.
Yeah, so exactly. And that's actually leads me to my next question is, so I'm somewhat familiar with like the musical world. There was like a time in my life where I was really into it. I've kind of passed out of that phase, but
still love the pirate movie.
Hey, well, I'm talking about actual like live performance.
Got it.
I still love movie musical, but like live performance musicals. And so I'm curious for you, Andy, is this something where you already had knowledge of the Broadway musical before seeing the film, or did the film introduce you to the musical?
The second one, the film introduced me to the musical. Yeah, I think I was preteen when this came out. And then, but my mom and I went to go see this live in Toronto when it toured. Eventually. Hmm. So
wow.
I did get to see it live. And there are big differences between the live, like Broadway musical or the theatrical musical versus the box office film version of this story. So it's interesting. They did not keep it true to what the Broadway musical was. And that is some of the theories of why this flopped a bit in the box office. Maybe why like a lot of people haven't seen it yet. Yeah.
Oh, I briefly read about that. One thing that I read, correct me please if I'm wrong, but that in the musical version of the story, Sheila does get to move forward. So she's the one that kind of has like, I don't know, I don't want to say chip on her shoulder, but she is like a little bit over kind of this whole thing. And she was the one that I was like commenting to Derek, like, does she already have an in? Because she was like not rehearsing or auditioning in the same way that all the other dancers were, but she still made it to the final 20.
I know you mean now.
Yeah.
Okay.
And she had like the black full leotard.
She's the older female character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm doing air quotes because
she's
almost 30.
Yeah, like a 9-year-old.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, they complain about their age and they're like all lying about their age, but they're all in their early 20s or late 20s. Like, although she does say, I'm looking forward to turning 30 real soon. And it's kind of obvious she's the same age as Michael Douglas and like probably in her 30s already. So
that's right. Because she at one point says, we used to dance together, and then calls him out for being a bad dancer.
So since we're talking about differences between the actual Broadway musical and the movie, there was some trivia that I found where the original choreographer of the actual Broadway production was initially involved with the production of the film, but then left because he couldn't get the level of creative control
Michael
that he was looking
Bennett?
For. That's him.
Okay, yeah.
And he specifically advised not to put the main focus of the movie on the relationship between Zach and Cassie.
So yes. Okay.
When I think about that, it's the one
to talk
thing.
About that. Yep.
Yeah. Where I'm like, am I supposed to know these people? What's happening?
Okay, so I'm glad that you took us there. And just so you know, Andy, we can jump everywhere. Like, there's no, like, linear anything with us during the podcast. So
it's like the relationship between Zach and Cassie. So, it can be anything and go anywhere.
Yeah, and so, Andy, you just said you wanted to talk about that anyway. So we can totally just get into it. I'm very curious to know your thoughts on the relationship itself and then how much space it took up in the film.
Do you mean between Cassie and Zach? Go.
Yeah, like just because Derek and I couldn't. I mean, look, I'll lay our cards on the table. We just couldn't quite wrap our heads around, like, why is this such a huge, like, I get it more so for this being for Cassie, this character, somebody who she says, I haven't worked in over a year. She is maybe having to seriously confront the end of this particular career for her. So that I understand. I think that's very interesting. I would have loved to see just more of her grappling with that. The romantic relationship between her and Zach, I was kind of scratching my head over because it felt a little forced into the narrative. But that's just my opinion. And I really do want to know how you felt about it.
I think you hit the nail on the head about that as well. Like, in the original What I Did for Love was originally sung by Diana Morales, which arguably is the strongest female character in the musical. I hope I'm getting this right. And What I Did for Love was not about a love story between a man and a woman. What I Did for Love was about, like, what I did for the love of my craft, like a love of dance. Mm. Like, because this is so, like, here we go jumping around again, but, like,
that's okay.
The theme of what these chorus line dancers, like, sacrifice their bodies, their finances, their sanity, just to get one part to dance on stage. Like, Diana gives that wonderful monologue at the end. Like, why would anyone want to do anything else? Like, you've made it on Broadway. You've made it. You've become something. Like, that monologue is such a beautiful, it gives me chills just saying it. And that was supposed to be her song number that adds to, like, what this really was about. Like, it's really an ensemble piece. So I think Cassie as, like, kind of this main character coming in, I wonder if that's the disconnect between what the Broadway version was or the theater version was versus the film version.
Because I didn't have an issue with the character of Cassie. Again, I think it would have been really interesting to explore more.
We just spent 3/4 of the movie not really understanding the nature of what was going on between them.
Yeah.
And it distracts from everything else that the movie, and now I'm realizing the original musical, was really supposed to be about.
Yeah. And at one point, so I can't claim that I was able to do really exhaustive research on, like, the differences between the film and the musical. One thing I did read is that I want to say one of the performers who did the role, I'm assuming there's, like, probably more than one. Maybe it was the person who originated Sheila, perhaps, that she read something. And I, like, I love the director of the Richard Attenborough as Hammond from Jurassic Park. Like,
I was hoping you'd bring that up.
Yeah. Like, he's such a, like, just
the director
lovely,
was an actor and someone we know from Jurassic Park. Yeah.
Yeah. Such a lovely man. And I will always just have a fondness in my heart for him in that role. However, I guess he was quoted as saying, like, when somebody asked him, like, what's this film about? And he was like, oh, it's about, like, these, like, dance hopefuls trying to get their shot. And so in response to that statement, the person Sheila from Broadway was like, well, no wonder the film did horribly, because that's not at all what the story is about. It's about dancers who are on the cusp of of aging out of this career. And not being able to perform anymore. And so it's all of them desperate for one last chance to perform and do this thing that they love.
And that's that urgency and the high stakes of, like, what these people have put on the line and sacrificed their youth, their 20s, just to get that one shot. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And it is, that's why this is a fascinating film, because it, I always am kind of drawn into these stories of these people who just sacrifice, sacrifice, sacrifice. Like she, at one point, Cassie says, like, I've never even had an apartment that wasn't a sublet, you know, like,
yeah.
like yeah. nothing else in their yeah. life is stable. They, you know, you can kind of see between, I, maybe that was the point in one regard for Cassie and Zach's story of showing how like your dedication to your craft means, you know, other relationships are kind of thrown to the side. Like your central relationship yeah. is your career, your relationship yep. to your dance.
Yeah, so, Carrie and Zach's sorry. Relationship do, yeah, or Cassie, sorry, Cassie and Zach's relationship yeah. really do still play in that theme. Like she risked her relationship to go follow yeah. her dreams. Like it is yep. all connected. Yeah.
But it also, it was strange to me, like I'm not trying to just pummel this aspect of the film, but it was like, she left him and he does seem pretty upset about the fact that she did that. Although I guess he eventually kind of understands, but then there's like a,
like what you're trying to describe is exactly what was so frustrating during the entire yeah, like, first yeah. 3/4 of the movie.
But then it's also has this like lightheartedness to it where I'm like, well, just like how heartbroken are either one of you? Because it, like the part that actually was the most compelling to me because it felt the most real was when she was up there with them and they're in the middle of, you know, performing part of the dance and he's like really being hard on her. That felt the most yeah. real to me because
like
that was
no
like
head toss there and like, yes. yeah, she's doing, you're doing too much. Do it with the boys again. Like, yeah.
Yep. And him just like really humiliating her in front of everybody else. Like I didn't like him for that, but that felt the most authentic as far as like showing how he's channeling this anger and hurt that he feels.
Classic Zach or, behavior.
Classic Zach. Yeah.
or is he like just trying to be as effective and trying to prove a point to her that she can't see? Like he's like, this is why
that's
you're beyond chorus. Yeah. Like, and then my big question to you, sorry, it kind of leads into this is, that part in the story where he lines them all up, he's like, okay, Larry, line them up. And he pulls, you know, the first 8 forward and, you know, they all think they've made it.
Yeah.
And then he's like, thank you very much. I'm sorry. First line. And then they get crushed. Do you think that was cruel or do you think that was a gift to these actors or these dancers, these characters, to feel that they made it, even if it was for like a moment, like just this one moment to have that sensation of like, I made it on Broadway, even if he took it away right afterwards. Like,
that's such an interesting question.
Yeah.
Experience.
That's a fascinating question.
because on one hand, if the answer is he did it for the reason that you just mentioned, to give them like some glimmer of hope, that's almost more sadistic than I was giving Michael Douglas credit for. Zach, I'm sorry.
Zach.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it could be because I don't really know what the reason is. Like, I think the assumption is that you're getting called up to stay on the show, not getting called forward to get sent back.
Yeah. Well, that I'm so glad you brought that up, Andy, because as we were watching that happen, and realizing, like, there was a point where I was like, well, he called, because, like, there were 20 people, 21, actually, if you include Cassie.
Mm-hmm.
So 21 people made it to that point, but only 8 people were going to stick around. So that means that the majority of people were going to be dismissed. And so once he started calling more than that number of names, I was like, oh, well, this has to be the people that are actually getting
They're
dismissed.
They're dancers, not mathematicians.
I don't know. I don't think, oh, they did say how many there were. You're right. They did. Yeah.
But I was like, is this, I've never been in the competitive dance world. I did
no, you know
pom-poms
what?
In high what? School.
Oh God,
and there were cuts. I do remember there being cuts.
Aww.
But that's the extent.
That's way closer than I ever got to the competitive dance world.
So I don't know if that's how they do it.
It felt very Hell's Kitchen-y.
Yeah. Yeah. That you just revealed. Yeah, our bad reality television addiction. Anyway, go ahead, Andy.
Oh, but we all, as writers, not to the degree of like actors and dancers, but we're putting ourselves out there and we know what it's like to be rejected. But this is like your whole body, your everything is out there and how hard this is and heartbreaking this is. And how painstakingly just to fight for a fair wage, like even thinking about how these guys are making, like they all have second jobs. They're all juggling this, this wild roller coaster lives, and they're getting paid nothing. They're just chorus line, technically, like those themes of like what you're doing for the love of your craft, like back to that theme of like what I did for love. And then I think of today, like how writers and actors, like the recent strikes we're going through, and how the artists are always like carving out and fighting for that piece of the pie just so they can survive while pursuing their craft. Like, that theme still strikes true today, and it's so many years later, like so many decades later.
Absolutely. And I will admit that I probably have retained few character names because there's just such a huge,
Oh, the ensemble is so beautiful. Like, I think we know each other from UCLA professional program writing, and like, I love to write ensemble, and Clue and this movie are probably the reasons why I do, and I'm obsessed.
Oh, I love that. Well, okay. So he was, I think perhaps it was, I'm like literally looking at, that's not him. Okay. So the other blonde gentleman he was the one that earlier in the film kept asking like, how long are you going to keep us? How long are you going to keep us? Like, I have work at 4 o'clock.
Oh yeah.
And then Larry was like, well, I guess you're going to have to call in. And then he also, I'm pretty sure, was the same gentleman who later on in the film had his moment as Zach was kind of questioning everybody about their private lives, where he was talking about how he's married and has 2 kids, and how he has, like, I remember him saying, like, the sweetest little wife at home. And he eventually gets cut. And that to me was,
I think, like, his whole thing was like, what are we doing?
Yes.
Like, that was the essence of his statement to Zach. And Zach, I think, I don't know if he dramatically turned off his little light then or not.
But. Well, to your point, Andy, that was like, that was such a fascinating character to me because I didn't get, well, okay, that's not true. Sheila definitely had a kid. She admitted to that. I don't think anybody else mentions having a child. They all skew a little bit younger. But for him to be married with 2 kids, and I think he alluded to having, like, he was a server. I think that was the job that he was going to.
And a parent he was taking care of, I think, too. Yeah.
Oh, I missed that. Dog food. Yeah. So it's like, how is this? That, like, I don't actually like have any kind of critique of the choices that he's made, but it's an interesting choice that, like, he has all these responsibilities and he's still doing this thing. Carving, like, maybe he's been successful enough.
It's because it's what he loves to do.
It's what he loves to do. And I know that there's such a clock ticking on that type of career. That's why if it's okay to pivot, I was so
pivot.
I was so interested.
Pivot.
And Derek. Waited. My mind went to Chandler, but
we'll edit that out.
sorry.
No, that's okay.
That with with Ross.
All the boys. I am so curious about the character of Larry because I don't know if more information is given about some of the characters in the musical version, but I was like, it in part, probably in huge part, is because the actor who played this character, Terrence Mann, I thought was just phenomenal. I loved any second that he was on screen. And I was like, can we just do a movie about Larry? Because I was like, who is this guy? How does, like, maybe, I'm guessing he and Zach danced together back in the day. It seems like he is not an active performer anymore. Yet at the same time, when they, you know, move forward in these auditions, he very clearly tells everybody, watch Larry. He does exactly what I want him to do.
Yeah.
So Zach obviously has a lot of respect for Larry and what he still can do physically. So I, I, I don't know if I have like a very concrete question. I'm just curious what your thoughts are, Andy, on this character and the role he plays in this world.
Yeah, he's, I think what I really enjoy about him now that we're talking about it is his reaction to the dancers. Yes. Like acting is reacting. It's a very economical way right at the beginning to see the dynamic and what's going on. Like the way he reacts to like Sheila was like, don't you know the combination, Sheila? I knew it when I was in front, and him like laughing at
that. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Like, just like, oh, that's, yeah, obviously like they know each other. And then when Richie, who seems new, like jumps into his arms because like he's, and he's like, you can just bring it down a little bit. And he laughs at like how keen this new dancer maybe is. Like, you're like, oh, they're new. And then when he pulls people forward by numbers, I think he uses Connie's name. So he's like, oh, Connie's been around. Like Connie's like, she knows the lay of the land. Like it really gives you like a very, from a screenplay or screenwriter point of view, very efficient way of like figuring out the hierarchy, the dynamics, the status, and like that they all kind of know each other. They've all like the shared experience of being dancers, trying to make it on Broadway. Like, I think he just really is like that leader or that glue that brings them together. I think that's what I really enjoy about that character.
That was so well said. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. He was so phenomenal because of everything that you just said, like the way that he just really engages with the other characters and the familiarity that you pick up on through both sometimes dialogue, but mostly like, yeah, the way that he looks or laughs or smirks or whatever.
Even with Zach, like as an intermediary between, you know, what's going on between Zach and the dancers, between Larry and the dancers, between the dancers and Zach, like having him there, like you mentioned, he is like a great glue that keeps everything together.
And I loved that with him and Cassie specifically.
Yes.
I like that he had also kind of a backbone where he's like, look, I don't want to get in the middle of this. Like, whatever's going on with you and Zach, you figure it out. You can stay at my place. That's cool. But I just, like, don't want to get in the middle. And I was like, yes, thank you. Thank you for finally being that character who's,
some
like,
healthy not- boundaries with Cassie.
Yes. 1,000%. So I really appreciated that about him. And I just really liked, I guess, the portrayal that was one aspect of it and him standing up for himself in that regard. But then also what I took as like, again, kind of this respect that Zach had for him, because Zach could have been a little bit more like an even bigger of an asshole figure if he had just like bossed Larry around and didn't respect him. But I liked that they showed that that wasn't the case, that he, I think, had a lot of respect for Larry. And there was this camaraderie between them. I don't know. I'm just speaking for myself. But I just thought that that's what I picked up on. And I really liked that about this story.
It's like, but when you work with someone on a film or a project that you just trust each other and you know how to communicate with each other, it's just like, it just goes, it just flows and their creativity follows. Yeah.
Yep. And to your point and a point that Derek made much earlier. So Andy, you just were talking about your love of ensemble pieces and just the amazing talent that was displayed through all these different people that were in this film. And Derek, you spoke earlier as well about how sometimes that was pushed to the side because of this other storyline between Zach and Cassie. Mm-hmm. So I really do want to give time and attention to the ensemble cast.
Yes.
And just to follow that up, for you, Andy, you know, was there any one person that stood out to you in particular? Did you feel like there was like a really good balance between the characters? Was there anyone that you would have liked to have seen more of that was of the final 20?
I like all the, I just like ensembles. Mm-hmm. And then I like that the inspiration for this story was, you know, taking stories from all the dancers that the original writers and creators of this story, like they gathered these backstories, these beautiful specifics, all the hardships, like the specific challenges, the hopes, the dreams, the fears, the everything. And I think in its diversity, it was relatively brown, great, breaking at the time. Like,
yes,
I think Diana Morales was, oh mm-hmm. my goodness, what a deep character, like what a multi-layered mm-hmm. character, and her journey through the whole thing, especially when at the end she gets pulled forward, then she gets pulled back again. Like, she really goes through yeah. it at the end.
Yeah.
To get that final piece of the pie. Yeah. But her song is so, like, and her experience as a student who obviously experienced, like, some maybe either prejudice or like different challenges in terms of, like, how she experienced, being at a creative school or an art school, and that she found her own path and she found her voice and, like, why it was important to her. And she really listened to, like, the inner drum in her heart to follow this. Like, I think that's such an amazing, like, Diana's character is. And that's why I think I'm a little bit, like, reading some research about, like, the original versus, like, she didn't get to sing her song and, like, the song was about
yeah.
the ensemble and, like, the, like, what it was like to be in this community and to capture that from the 70s and what a challenge that was. Yeah, I think she's one that stood out for me. But I remember watching it as, like, a little girl for the first time and, like, cheering for different characters and really being engaged and scared of who was going to make it and who wasn't. And probably at the time, I connected probably most to, like, Christine Evelyn Ehrlich, who would talk in, like, a question for every sentence. And, you know, you're, like, not insecure. And, like, cause, like, that's how I felt as, like, a young girl watching it. And for her not to make it, like, to go through that as an audience member, like, that roller coaster of it, which is similar to Clue. You don't know how it's going to end. And I think I read somewhere the original Broadway or one of the versions of this had a different ending every time. Like, I could be wrong, and everything I've said before,
oh, wow.
all the stuff I've read. Yeah, but they were like, oh, this is just too hard to pull off. Like, for the finale, we can't, like, this is just a lot to manage. It's already so groundbreaking. And, like, how it was fit, like, how it was staged. Like, it's just an open stage with pretty minimal, like, you know, production besides all, obviously, the choreography. But that's what made the spotlight hit what the talent was and what we were really supposed to be focusing on. So,
man,
yeah, that was a lot.
You brought up so many good points. And I'm saying this out loud because hopefully it'll help me remember. You guys can remind me. I want to put a pin in the last thing you spoke of, which was
the different endings, like Clue.
No. Oh. That's a fun little connection there. The location, because Derek, you were talking about that last night. So I want to put a pin in that, but I think that is really interesting. So I do want to get back to that. But to the other points that you made, Andy, I mean, first of all, totally agree with you. I think what's so interesting, so obviously they cast, for the most part, I think there's just one exception, but they cast people who are, like, all legit dancers. And arguably, maybe that's how they would first see themselves before actors or singers.
Double threat.
In terms of, like, going through IMDb for, it is such a huge ensemble, but, like, for, you know, at least a dozen of the people that I was kind of researching, it seems like really dancing was their first love. Most of them don't have extensive IMDb in terms of, like, maybe more just, quote, straight acting gigs.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Yeah, but they all did to that point, though. Like, I thought they were all amazing. And it felt very, in a certain regard, then it kind of takes me back to, like, old Hollywood, where that was very normal, where you had these individuals who were, you just said, like, triple threats, kind of. Like,
I said double threat, but I should have said triple
threat.
Oh, double, sorry.
Yeah. Triple threat. Where, you know, I'm thinking of, like, you know, people like Gene Kelly, where obviously, he was a phenomenal dancer. I love watching every single second of him, but also great singer and a great actor who had range.
Yeah.
You know, and I think nowadays, a lot of people, you know, I know that people will maybe call themselves hyphenates, but at the same time, the people that we think of as, like, really legit actors, like, nobody's asking Leonardo DiCaprio to sing or dance. You know, so.
We don't know that.
Ryan Gosling can dance a pretty good step.
That's true. That's a good exception. Emma Stone, sure. La La Land. And actually, we were just talking about that, too, when the film ended, of, like, when's the last time we saw a film kind of in the same world, like a more recent movie. But for, I want to say her first name is Yamil Borges, who played Morales. This was, like, her first credit. And
yeah, I think it's a couple.
Great.
Yeah. They were all fairly early in their careers. So I'm blown away by that, about how impactful they were, in that regard. And like, I didn't for anybody think, oh, well, this is obviously a dancer who they just needed for that skill set, but they're not really great at the acting part. I didn't think that really of anybody. I will say, this circles back to one of your other points, Andy. So the character of Christine, who off the top of your head, Derek, do you know who that is? She's the one that was married to the other guy.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay, so that character.
The guy that we thought was maybe the guy from Grease 2, but was
not.
I think his name's Al. Yeah.
Great. Thank you for that. Yeah. Great similarity between the two of them. So she is the actual in real life daughter of Bob Fosse.
Okay.
And I love kind of the wink of including somebody who is the daughter of arguably the most like famous person like associated with Broadway. I think that's really fun. I don't know to what degree she like want, like, I don't, cause like, I felt like, okay, well, if you're going to include Bob Fosse's daughter, would you not give her more to do? But I did like the character, because I think you're totally spot on, Andy, that she really kind of shows that vulnerability that a lot of other performers maybe try to downplay more. And she just, I don't think, had that capability. Like, she just was like, yeah, I'm nervous. I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that transparency. But I just thought it was an interesting casting choice, because I would have thought, you know who I thought she was? I thought she was, and this is one of the female dancers who does get put into the final group, the one that had kind of the green two-piece leotard.
Oh, Bebe, and she had like,
Bebe?
Yes.
Bebe.
Thank you. Yeah. I thought, oh, that must be Bob Fosse's daughter.
You did say that.
Yeah. And I was wrong. Because she had a little bit more to do in the film. Maybe. And yeah. But what do you think, Andy? Do you think that like it was a totally legitimate casting choice to have her in that role? Maybe it was intentional to just like have her be part of it but not have a main role. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting because those two dance side by side at the beginning. When she was like, she did that vulnerable, like she, you know, forgot the steps. Like, and it looked legit. Like, it looked like I believed that she was like struggling with the choreography, and then, you know, Bebe is like, this is how you do it. This is right. And even she's surprised that she's getting pulled to the front to, and like, that is like a mesmerizing solo that she gets to do at the beginning there. Then everyone, you know, follows suit and does that stretch of the number. Mm-hmm. But, no, I think that was well cast. Like, I do believe her vulnerability and and how connected she is to her husband and how young she is. Like, I wonder how young she really was when it came out, and if it really just played from like, it was so genuine, I think.
And probably, I mean, that's a lot to carry on your shoulders to be the daughter of Bob Fosse. So
maybe there's other, like royalty, like there's other like in the original, Robert Lapone played Zach, and that's Patti LuPone's brother.
Yeah. Okay.
But that's in the original, not in the movie. But and then the other cool kind of like IMDb, like, I hope I get this right, connecting all the dots, is the person who was the inspiration for Sheila, who got to play Sheila in the Broadway version and won a Tony. She wasn't cast in the movie, but she's a current working actress. And she played, I guess, the Gilmore Girls, like, I'm assuming, grandmother Emily Gilmore, so like the older and then she's also, what else is she in that she's quite famous for? She played the mom in Dirty Dancing, like Baby's mom, like Francis's mom. What is that famous line she says, like, she gets that from me. I believe, oh god, I hope I get this right, you have to know if I don't, but that's Kelly Bishop, who I think the original role of Sheila was inspired by.
Oh, I love that.
But she wasn't in the movie. Yeah.
Okay.
And like,
sure.
I love so much about that character. Gosh, like, talk about survival mechanisms and how she's, I think her point of view as a character, like Sheila's character, is like, mm-hmm. I'm going to surprise everybody. Like, I'm mm-hmm. going to keep doing this, obviously, into my 30s. I mean, not so obvious, but, and how mm-hmm. she like snaps back, like, to everyone. Like, when she's, even when she's talking to Zach again and she's like, can I sit on your lap? And he's like, mm-hmm. Do you normally come on like this? Well, normally I'm aggressive. like just how everything she says is quite witty and surprising. And I just, like, again, ensemble, like, every character just has this, like, unique point of view and such depth and backstory. And just really speaks to the uniqueness. Everyone on stage has their struggles and has their story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that is what I think about that, that part of the movie, which should be like the predominant, like, that is really like the main story. It once again makes me feel a little bad that so much effort was put into like the romance that mm-hmm. like the original choreographer didn't even think mm-hmm. should have been stressed as much. But it also makes me feel like A Chorus Line is in some ways, in my mind, like a spiritual successor to another movie that we had like covered mm-hmm. earlier, Fame. Mm-hmm. Only we're like looking at different ends of the spectrum for people that were like pursuing this kind of passion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, we saw them all like just getting into school and just trying to figure out how to make something out of school. And then this is seeing, you know, people who have been doing this long enough to
where
on the tail end.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's like an interesting way of like thinking of movies from that decade mm-hmm. that we don't see anymore. Mm-hmm. And you'd mentioned that, Anna, and I kind of blame reality TV. Like, so you think you can,
yeah.
all those shows, like, oh. like American Idol, all of these TV reality TV shows have taken the place in some ways of these types of like just movie stories.
That's a fascinating observation. Yeah. I never even thought about that, but I think you're right. I think that we see so much of the day to day of because of reality television, yeah. like it's like constant.
Yeah.
And you're totally right. Like between those shows, and like I used to, for a while, was like a very faithful viewer of So You Think You Can Dance. I loved that show. There were like definitely some favorites, and yeah, and same thing like The Voice, American Idol. Like we see that just in a different way now, instead of kind of this more dramatic depiction.
It never
of it.
Went away. It was so popular mm-hmm. that it's like it's everywhere.
That's so interesting to think about it.
Well,
that
we love
way.
Hearing individual stories and then like mm-hmm. cheering for what we really relate to. Like I connect to all these characters in some way, shape, or form. And like having relatable characters, whether they're likable or not, like this really like that's what makes a great story for me.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know if I'm gonna be able to articulate this well, but I can connect to the stories in this film and to your point, Derek, like I felt the same way in the film Fame. Then in contrast, I feel like sometimes it becomes a really kind of cheap gimmick.
Because they're not like, so they're real people, but they're not characters
yeah,
in a story. Like, and that's kind of what I would like to see.
In those reality television shows, like I almost kind of come to roll my eyes where every single person has a sob story. And it's just interesting how in reality television, they like really push it, push it, push it, push it. But in film, they do it in such a nuanced way that you can still resonate. Like it doesn't feel like they're just looking for like a cheap way of getting your emotions pulled into the storytelling. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I think A Chorus Line, from what I've read, again, like everything I'm saying is what I've read about. And there is like a documentary from like, I want to say 10 or 15 years ago, like Every Little Step maybe is what it's called. Oh. I haven't been able to find it. But, and I wonder like how accurate that is on like, who was the original idea. But like, from what I understand, it is based on like, A Chorus Line characters are based on like real people. Like a lot of them are based on like dancers that existed at the time in the 70s when this was like, you know, brought together and created. And then I think I read somewhere too that Paul was a groundbreaking character, but it's also based on one of the original writers, like real life, like they used parts of their life or their experience and put that on stage. I think Dante was the name of, like, Nicholas mm-hmm. Dante, maybe, was the one who wrote mm-hmm. the book that goes along with the musical. Mm-hmm. And how that was a groundbreaking character. And going back to fame, like, again, as a Caucasian woman who's grown up with mm-hmm. a lot of white privilege, mm-hmm. having diversity in this and like Leroy from Fame and then Richie from A Chorus Line, they were like amazing African-American characters. And from what I've read online, like dancers who played that role really like aspired, like that was like the role, like it was a complex character and had a lot to say. And mm-hmm. I think that this is groundbreaking and that it did speak to themes of homosexuality, body mm-hmm. image, representing a diverse cultures. I just, I think this is such a wonderful story. And one thing I was going to quote is Lin-Manuel Miranda, the creator of Hamilton, even credited Diana. I'm actually going to quote this. This is from an article, but credits Diana with paving the way for his Latino-centered musical In the Heights. And she's the reason we're all here. Like, he stated that in an interview in the LA Times in 2008. So a long time ago, but a lot of this was, you know, paved a way for other things to happen. And I wonder if A Chorus Line is a little bit of like what made the formula for what makes reality TV work. Like, we care about individual stories and we can relate to these hopes and fears and struggles because, you know, we all have that. It's, mm-hmm. I don't know, I think there's such a, and that's what artists love. Like this choosing to be a dancer and that's how your method of expression of mm-hmm. this experience of humanity. Like, that's what I think is so relatable.
It's
like sacrificing everything for that. Yeah.
It's weird because the performers on the reality shows at this point, it's clear that some, not all, are there less because they have a specific passion for like dance or singing and more because they want to be in the public spotlight more mm-hmm. generally. They want to be, you know, they want to get more clicks or mm-hmm, followers. Mm-hmm. And certainly by the time you get to the end of those shows where there are people who are like really strong performers, that's probably less the case. But I think to your point, as far as like whether one side or the other feels like it's like cheapened or whether things are trying to be like forced, I think that's why, like from my perspective, I would prefer if I'm watching something, I would prefer to see something where like care and attention has been put into putting a compelling story mm-hmm. with characters that aren't real. They might be based on real people, but it's done in a way with more nuance and like less of that like gimmicky approach mm-hmm. that you would see in the reality stuff. And that's probably why like I'm aware of the reality competition shows. I was never as much of a passionate follower of So You Think You Dance as you were. But I'm not as interested in those, but I'll watch a movie like Fame or I'll watch a movie like Chorus Line. And at first I'm getting like the vibes. I'm feeling like, I don't know if I'm interested in this because of those shows. But then when the movie is allowed to like kind of fully unfold and give you the story, mm-hmm. I just much more prefer those.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, to your point, Andy, absolutely. And even just like a role like Kim, who was Zach's assistant, like she was that character was a Black woman. And there was like just the normalcy of like having like she could have been of any race, like it, but they made a choice to have that character be a Black. And I just things like that where it's like you just normalize.
Yeah.
That
I think
there
it's
can
important
be,
to make those choices. Yes. Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. And I mean to also that point, Richie, where it kind of, like I think he said it at least twice, where he is like talking about himself, and then the last thing he says is, "And I'm Black," and it's like we know that, you know. And I don't think it was a joke at his expense that was part of the dialogue, but I think that in a weird way, it's like, hey, I am a Black man, but I'm qualified to be here and I made it this far. And he eventually does become one of the final eight. And I think that is a very important part of the representation of this story and this film. And I loved those moments. yeah, I agree with all your points. And one thing that I wanted to bring up with Paul, so this is the character, in case, you know, for people who are following along, it's hard to keep people straight just by name alone. Paul also happens to be the character who hurts himself.
Yeah, they foreshadow that.
Prior surgery, yeah.
Yeah. So we see in the film much, much earlier.
Well, they foreshadow that when he was talking to Diana. Is that what you mean? That foreshadowed part?
Yeah. He was like retaping an already severely taped up knee. Yeah. The sound design where like we're at a distance when he falls, but oof, that noise was.
That was brutal.
Brutal.
I sometimes have to fast forward that part. I find it so intense.
it's a really tough thing.
If you don't know what's
happening,
it just happens. Yeah. It's like, holy shit.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I responded. But what I thought was, I mean, first of all, you're heartbroken for him because now you've come to know this character and you've heard his story and you've heard how he was like sexually abused as a child and just came from a challenging upbringing generally. So just the look on everybody's face when he gets hurt, you know that they're all thinking this is it for him.
And Michael Douglas was basically shaking his head to confirm everyone's worst fears.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
But
high the stakes are. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. They got New York's best knee guy.
Yeah. I love how they're like, we're taking you immediately to the best knee guy in New York. I thought that was just like a really funny kind of movie thing. But anyway.
The best one.
Wow. The best
but
one.
But I also believe that, I totally believe that Zach would know who that is. Like,
I did
buy it for the 80s. Like, I felt like back then that's something that Zach would know.
I think I was like thinking more as like an American healthcare user where I'm like, there's no way that Paul can afford the best knee guy in New York. But
well, I was assuming Zach was going to pay for it. Like, that's why I think Zach truly did care about these characters. When I asked that original question, like, why did he pull these people forward? I think he genuinely cared. He has a job to do and it's like a heartbreaking job, but I think he genuinely wanted to hear everyone's story. Yeah.
Well, you know,
I was just going to say like, along it, like within that, with that thought, after the accident, where Zach, one thing that I really wish they actually would have stayed on more and had some deeper conversation around it is when Zach says, what are you all going to do when you can't dance anymore?
Yeah.
And, you know, a couple of them make jokes. Like, I think it's Connie who says, like, I'll go off my diet.
back to the body image theme. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, this is a conversation I want to hear. Like, I really want to hear people talking about what is the next stage of your life. And that's the one thing that I felt was like, I really was left craving from this film and this story is like hearing people's thoughts. Like, maybe they're just too terrified to really confront that. But I really wanted to hear some real answers from people about what they envision themselves doing. Because, like, yeah, how old was Paul? 25? Like,
yeah, it sounds right.
You know, and that might have been his last day dancing. So even with New York's best knee doctor. So it's like there's a lot of life left, you know, for that person, for all of them, even Sheila, who's about to turn 30. So I just find that part of it really fascinating too, because I think that that's something that a lot of people in creative fields have to at some point confront. There are many types of creativity that is not sustainable over the course of a lifetime for whatever reason, whether it's the physicality of it or, you know, like I know for some people, like, well, who was I reading about recently that was a painter and they just had to stop because their eyesight became so poor. Things like that. And so it's like, so then what do you do when this thing that you've known and loved and you've devoted your life to is something you can no longer do?
Yeah, I have two trains of thought with that. Like, I wonder, like, my first thought is like, did they foreshadow that a little bit? Like, for example, Al and Christine, the married couple, like, I can see them having kids very shortly after this not being cast. Like, going back to the Bronx and having like a family life, or Sheila maybe marrying Rich. I don't know. But then I also think like when you're so committed to your craft, you don't have like the time to even contemplate what's next. You have to be so just all in. And like, and to be all in, knowing that at any moment you could spin, lose your knee, and it's all gone, mm-hmm. is like part of the urgency and the like, the sacrifice and the energy of like what this life is like and how intense it is. Like, it's not for the weak at heart. And same thing with like when, you know, we talk about trying to make it in Hollywood as a writer, as an mm-hmm. actor, like if there's anything else you can do, do it is kind of the advice they say, because mm-hmm. it's so all consuming, so self-sacrificing. And yeah. And for what? Not for like a lot of money or fame. You're a chorus line. You're just on stage. Mm-hmm. You're not like, but to just have your little piece of history and to say something about the human experience in whatever, mm-hmm. in this way you express yourself is just, yeah, for me, that's what it's about. And like why I find it so inspiring. But you're right. I would like to know what they all are going to do. Like that is, that would be like, if I was going to write some fan fiction, I would like have them like all vote for Drake after this and be like, okay, so we didn't make it. What are we going to do?
Because that is, I think, just, you know, and maybe it's because of exactly what you just said, of being somebody who wants to be creative in another realm of the industry, you know, and I mean, we had classes together where like we had a couple people, I'm not going to like dox anybody, but like basically some of our lectures where they were like, you can't have a plan B. If you have a plan B, then you're never going to like really devote yourself. So that's a really interesting conversation to me about people's takes on that.
That like, sounds like something someone would say who's got some money to make on people not having a plan B.
or like, and this I'll say, because like I think he's been very, very candid about not necessarily recommending this path for other people, but like the filmmaker Mark Duplass, you know, talks about how like I think his first big kind of foray into filmmaking, he just like put everything on a credit card and was like, I don't really recommend doing that.
That's,
you know,
one
like,
hell of a credit card. I mean, if you're just get, that's well, kind of a, if it's generous like limit,
micro budget, you know, whatever.
Fair enough.
So
get some points back, you know.
There is just a really interesting, because, and then we talked about this point at the very early part of our conversation, just in terms of the relationship between Zach and Cassie and why that didn't work out, because she was devoted to her career and went and followed the next opportunity. So I think that that's just in general a really interesting conversation to be had about like how much do you devote to this thing that you love to the exclusion of everything else.
So we got
to
find this, because if this
is like, we got to find the answer.
If this is in some ways a spiritual successor to Fame, that we have to find the spiritual successor to Chorus Line.
To a Chorus Line.
Where everyone's in their like 40s.
Yeah.
Working at Kinko's. I don't know. Oh. I don't know why I thought Kinko's.
Or a drama teacher.
Oh, Andrea.
Oh, I love my job. I love my job.
And you were like, literally...
Yeah,
you were just in LA the summer at Growling, so don't even act like you're not able to put,
And the Kinko's was supposed to be a reference to like the 90s when I'd have it set in.
Sure, are there
I don't think there are
anymore?
Now.
Yeah, I don't think there's Kinko's anymore.
So it would be a period piece.
Be like working at Radio Shack.
Aww. I'm pretty sure there's one Kinko's left.
There's one Kinko's left where everybody goes to work. Who's a former dancer.
But my answer to that is know thyself. Like, I think you need to know like what you want to sacrifice. How do you carve out what you need in terms of your self-expression, your self-actualization, mm-hmm. if you're looking at like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but like, how do you sustain a life that like is comfortable or like is, you know, or just a survival mode, or like, it depends what you want to sacrifice and how you thrive and how you survive. Like, I think you need to just try all the things and like try to be bold and take creative risks, and it's what everyone's comfortable with. And I think like what saddens me a little bit is like how you do really have to a lot of times sacrifice so much and be so dedicated to really make it. And that's not for everybody. Like, that's not everyone's temperament, I think. I don't know. It's, I don't know. It's a lot to think about.
It is. It's and it is like a real, like, it's not something you figure out in an afternoon. It's like, honestly, something you figure out over a lifetime. If you are pursuing something within that field. I mean, This has been just an... Oh, one thing. I didn't want to steal your thunder, Andy. When you were talking about the, like, you know, kind of dancing royalty and different individuals who have been part of A Chorus Line in its many different versions. When we were emailing about the show, you brought up somebody. And it's a kind of fun little...
Oh, because we haven't talked about this character yet. Judy.
No.
So the, yeah. The character who was like, I don't know, was she... from El Paso, Texas.
Yep.
She is Janet Jones, credited in A Chorus Line, the movie. But she used to be on Dance Fever, and I think that's how she met Wayne Gretzky. And she is now married and still married to Wayne Gretzky with 5 kids. And her daughter, Paulina, is married to, oh, I think it's Dustin Johnson, the golfer.
Yeah.
Do I have the right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
A couple of the golfers I mix up. I think that's the right golfer.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But, but yeah, pretty like, I don't know. So she's technically Janet Gretzky, I think, now, but that's kind of an interesting Canadian, for me, a Canadian reference being a Canadian. And then
there you go.
I can do that character. Jeff Hislop used to play that character in the touring, and he was part of like a kid's show called Today's Special in Canada. So I don't know, just kind of interesting to see, like, there's a lot of these like interesting little connections of, you know, how people find their craft. Like, not everyone's an A-list actor. Not everyone knows who they are, but they had this beautiful, like, they left their presence on stage.
Yep.
And I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I thought that was really fun. The Janet Jones connection. And Derek and I are, neither of us are Canadian, but we do love hockey. And so it was a fun little, like, oh, that's Gretzky's wife.
Yeah. You miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
There you go. Yeah. He's
Dustin Johnson. Did I say Johnson? Yeah.
Oh, but you were right. And so, like, now at this point, Janet and Wayne Gretzky are grandparents, because I'm pretty sure that their daughter and the golfer, they've already had a kid.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wonder if they watch A Chorus Line. like there's grandma, there's mom. Like, that's
going to be so wild. Yeah, too. And she actually reminded me a lot of Cynthia Rhodes from Dirty Dancing, Penny. And just like they had the same kind of like physicality, because she also was a dancer who had kind of roles here and there. She was also in Flashdance. Cynthia Rhodes was, but yeah, they had the same kind of dancer's body. So they just had a similarity that struck me. In any case,
it reminded me of my favorite Gretzky reference, which of course is Gretzky had it, lost it.
Oh, I mean, he's such a this is certainly not going to be a hockey podcast,
which is a great Red Wings St. Louis Blues reference.
Sure. Yes, sure. Yes. He's such an interesting figure, because he, you know, undeniably is the best hockey player of all time, but he is such an interesting.
It didn't go well when he coached
because it is so instinctual to him. Yeah. And then I think that's interesting that he marries somebody that, for her, she has her own physical kind of like passion.
Yeah.
So that was maybe a way that they connected. But in any case, this has been just an amazing conversation. And given everything that we've talked about, I think it feels like the natural way to wrap up is just, we've kind of mentioned here and there, the way that stories like this have continued to permeate in culture, and how I think you made an excellent point, Derek, in terms of reality television and how that's how we tend to see these stories now.
I want to make one slight amendment to that, which is while I would prefer something like A Chorus Line or Fame for like the true narrative, like an actual, like, well put together script.
Yeah.
I would say I would still rather just watch a documentary.
Oh,
if we wanted to have something like similar to like the realistic approach of a reality TV.
Okay.
That's all I'll say.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Andy, what I was going to ask is just, you know, do you think, so this was 85 and, you know, we did mention La La Land. So that was a few years back, and that's kind of a variant in terms of, you
Common
know,
themes.
Creative individuals trying to make their way in the world. So do you think that a story like this does still hold up? Do you think that people who are in their late teens, early 20s, who are just starting out on their creative careers, could resonate with a story like this? Do you think that this just hit for you because you saw it at a certain time in your life where you were also within this world and understood it and were pursuing it? Like, what, where do you think it stands now as a film that can speak to individuals who are pursuing creative fields?
I think it's timeless. I think it's such a beautiful snapshot of the challenges of, like, I guess the 70s and 80s. But I think it's, the themes are universal in that, like, everyone has, you don't know what people's individual struggles are. Like, it's a very empathetic and relatable journey, all of these characters, and how high the stakes are, and how to follow your passion with, like, bravery, and what a courageous thing to try to pursue. And it's worth it. You're all in this together, like, this shared experience of this following your dreams. I think that's, it's, I think it's relatable to, I think it's timeless. And I think I'm glad that it speaks, and there's this snapshot of what things might been on Broadway. And Broadway back in that time was not like what it is today. Like, it wasn't such a touristy area. I think it was more of a challenging part of New York to be in. So I like the grittiness of Fame, and not as gritty as A Chorus Line's not as gritty, I think, as Fame, but I do love that this is that snapshot of time and what people's experiences were and how challenging it was to have these kind of specifics and how brave it was to share their stories. Because at the very beginning of this movie, they don't want to speak. They're like, well, I just want to dance. Like, what are we talking about ourselves? Like, what's this all about? And I think there was a song in the original number that had something to do with that, but I might be remembering incorrectly. But how that journey of, like, being, how vulnerable you have to be on stage. And that does connect to what ends up being, like, in the actors that make it. They have that vulnerability that they can show and that we really connect to. And I just think this was so well cast and so well written. Despite the focus on the love story, I still watch this. This is one of the ones I've watched 100 times. Like, this is my go-to. And some of these songs are my shower songs, like what I will sing in the shower. So, yeah.
I love that.
I hope more people watch it. I hope more people watch it, even though it's, like, from the 80s. I hope this is one of those ones that people start to discover again, like how people do. Maybe TikTok. We can watch them on get someone to talk about it on TikTok, and then people will watch it again.
I just love listening to you articulate about this world and just what you take away from it and what it explores. And that was just so beautifully said. I'm so glad that we got to talk about, first of all, thank you.
I wouldn't have seen this.
Yeah. Thank you for suggesting this film, because we were not familiar.
Two people down, more people to go.
Everyone to go.
Although I would think that maybe, and again, like, I'm not connected to this industry enough to know, but I would guess that maybe people who are in the dance world and the Broadway world, they probably know this movie and, like, look to it. Cause I do think it, from my standpoint, gives a really authentic depiction. Cause, like you said yourself, Andy, like, it's drawn from actual stories, that the creators
of
the musical.
That's what I've read. That's my understanding. Yeah.
And so it's like, well, you don't get any more authentic than that. But yeah, to the rest of the public, I do hope that it becomes a film that gets on more people's radars. And I'm really grateful to you that we did get to see it because of that. So thank you. And at the top of our conversation, when I was introducing you, I was just talking about the wonderful creative things that you do. And I was wondering if you wanted to share with our listeners maybe where they can find you and see what you're up to.
I like to make crazy comedy characters on TikTok. So, that's what you do on TikTok, right?
Absolutely.
Weird stuff. I'm at Andy's characters or Andy characters. Yeah. Just fun to play. You always see what I really look like, because I'm usually wearing a wig and doing some weird stuff and trying to give bad advice, or like, or I play a character called Inflation who's trying to apologize, but like, it's all just silly weird stuff.
And we'll make sure to have your handle in the show notes so that people can also find it and find you. And just thank you again, Andy, for coming back to the show. We're so lucky that you wanted to and that you want to talk about this film. It was really, truly our pleasure to have you.
Oh my gosh, Derek and Anna, thank you so much. I love these kind of conversations. And I love your podcast. Big fan, second time on.
Thanks, honey. Andy, you were phenomenal, just like last time. Thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm actually very curious.
Yeah?
Derek, would you watch this film again?
I rarely give this answer, but I probably would not.
Okay.
And that's because over a week later, I still have that goddamn song stuck in my head.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I don't know if it's starting to fade a little bit. I don't know if I need that. I don't know if I need that again haunting me for the next month.
You're
for another month.
Almost like what's the word I'm looking for? Like a little resentful of just the present earworm that it's a good song.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm glad that I had the opportunity to see it. I'm glad that it was picked and that we got to watch it, because it's probably not a movie that I would have gravitated to. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed it. I don't know if I'm going to watch that or if I'm going to watch one of the movies that I've already seen for the 100th time again.
I mean, this is very rare, that the fact that it was a first screening for both of us. I think the only one that's actually off the top of my head, I think the only other one that's happened with was Fire with Fire.
Yeah,
I think every other film, at least one of us has seen it.
Yeah.
So, we talk a lot with Andy about this world and, how fascinating it is to watch a depiction of people who are just so passionate and devoted to this craft to almost the exclusion of everything else, and sometimes let other parts of their lives fall to the wayside because of it. And I find that really interesting. I think that, like, in a matter of speaking, I can see that in day-to-day life with other people, and and so, you know, being even remotely part of a creative industry, you do see that. And so I think that, I don't know, in some ways that makes it more interesting to watch a film like this, in some ways just like really familiar. I think that it's one of those circumstances where if it was on TV, I was scrolling, I would just keep it on.
Yeah,
and
that's
watch
fair.
It again.
Yeah, I wouldn't like scroll. If it was on in that kind of set of circumstances, I'd probably keep it on. But I don't know if it is.
I don't know if it is.
I don't know if I've ever seen it, just like,
I mean, now we'll look.
Yeah.
So call to action.
Yeah. What do you got?
I mean, I don't know what I got. I think that, maybe at the top of our conversation, we were talking about the differences between the film and the musical.
Mm-hmm.
People who are more familiar, well, I mean, maybe not more, but equally familiar with the musical could speak to the differences and whether or not they prefer the changes that were made for the film. I'd be really interested in hearing them talk about that.
From what I've gathered is that overall people prefer the actual musical, but that the finale was very well done.
Right.
And I think that makes sense, because I thought, like, once you get maybe 2/3 through the movie, it really starts picking up steam. And then the finale was like way over the top impressive.
Yeah.
It was really good.
I think something else I would really love to just hear thoughts on. So this film's 85, and to some degree, you know, when we were talking with Andy in particular, we were talking about, like, what this world was like then,
mm-hmm.
if it's still like that now, the way that other creative industries kind of mirror what we see in terms of, like, sacrifice and passion and all of that. So I would just be really curious to hear from people who maybe are in the dancing world, and, like, does this film still resonate for them? And, you know, is there still similarity? Has it evolved in any way, hopefully in a more positive way? I don't know. But if you want to reach out, we would love to hear from you. You can contact us through Facebook, Twitter X. That's just what I'm, instead of like Jason X, Twitter X. I'm just going to call it that from now on. Instagram. It's the same handle for all three. It is at 80s Montage Pod, and 80s is 80s. Sneak peek.
Yeah, what do we got?
My clue? My clue.
This is a tough one.
What's the word I'm looking for? Like, disjointed music? That's my clue?
Oh, man. From a musical where the music was really tight and obviously appropriate, and it all was very deliberate.
Yeah.
If we're talking about a movie from the 80s with music that maybe doesn't match, the first thing that comes to mind is, of course, the Matthew Broderick powerhouse that is Lady Hawk.
Of course.
Also featuring Michelle Pfeiffer and Rutger Hauer.
Of course. Of course that's the first thing that comes to mind.
It is. It just is. Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I know you really enjoy this film. I am not as familiar with it.
It's a fun movie.
So that one is on deck, so to speak. And in the meantime, just thank you to everybody for hanging with us. We really appreciate, with all the choices out there, that you listen to our podcast. And we will talk to you again in 2 weeks' time.